This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Hundreds of movement leaders, activists, organizers, funders, and journalists gathered in Atlanta, Georgia in June 2023 at A Light, A Line, A Rise, an invitation-only conference on reparations organized by the Decolonizing Wealth Project. As the conference's media partner, Yes Media spoke with more than a dozen prominent organizers, activists, and leaders. Among them was Jessica Ann Mitchell Iwuyor, a multicultural communication specialist and the founder of the National Black Cultural Information Trust.
I'm Jessica Ann Mitchell Iwuyor. Most folks just call me Jam or Jam Iwuyor. I'm the founder of the National Black Cultural Information Trust. We share news, information, resources that uplifts the collective freedom of Black communities and also challenges cultural mis- and disinformation.
Well, we live at a time when information is so important and, is so easily accessible and informs the conversations around especially race and racial justice, and things move at lightning speed. Tell me whether you think overall the digital revolution has helped or hurt causes of racial justice, causes around reparations in particular.
I think it's definitely helped. It's given more access to voices that traditionally would be sidelined. We've seen the rise of Black Lives Matter. We've seen the rise of Me Too and various social justice movements. And they really probably wouldn't have spread as far if we hadn't had that digital revolution, that the accessibility, the ability for anyone to be able to pick up their cell phones and spread their message with the entire world.
So basically, historically excluded voices from traditional media created their own media.
Yes, they did. Created their own media, created their own platforms, built their own communities. So the digital space has been very important. Now, there are negatives. There's always a negative. Sometimes in the digital space, it is very easy to co-opt a message. It's easy to, become like a Trojan horse in a sense and start using a hashtag in a malicious way. Those things do happen. Some people create fake accounts pretending to be a part of a movement and then taking advantage of the situation to sway people one way or the other. Those things do happen. But overall, the digital space has been an advantage specifically to people of African descent who have not always been given the microphone, not always been elevated. We've been able to elevate and push ourselves out into the mainstream. Like, you're going to hear us. It's not going to be so easy to ignore what we have to say.
And then do you feel that that has been a big reason or one reason why there is increased attention to the issue of reparations now?
Definitely. It definitely has. Especially with what we've seen over the last few years with George Floyd and more. There's been an ongoing conversation in the digital space on what happens to people of African descent in this country and what has always happened to us. And we know that that links back to the era of chattel slavery, Jim Crow, and all its current vestiges that currently affect us today. So I think it definitely has had an impact on the reparations movement and the ability to grow support and build strength behind it, especially in digital spaces.
What do reparations mean to you? I mean, it's a big word, it's a big concept, even if it might be sort of a straightforward concept. Is there, does, for example, the media owe reparations?
I think the media does owe reparations. I know there's an organization that tackles that. I think it's Media 2020.
2070.
Yeah. Oh, Media 2070, yeah. But I do think so. Ida B. Wells spent so much of her life trying to document the lynchings that happened to African Americans. And it was the Black newspapers that carried those stories. And most of the mainstream newspapers were not accurately covering what was going on in this country. And sometimes, and actually often mainstream media would be used to create more racial animus towards African Americans. And so, yes, I do think media owes reparations. But for me, reparations means repair. The root of it means to repair. And there have been so many harms that have been done to people of African descent since we've made it to these shores, since we've been brought here. And I think that it's going to take a lot to do restoration, to do repair, but it can happen. I think it can happen in our lifetime.
How do you talk about issues like reparations? Tell me about the way in which you've made a space for yourself, in a manner that is becoming increasingly typical for people whose voices have historically been excluded.
Well, I have a very non-traditional background. I always wanted to tell our stories and, most importantly, know the history. So as an undergrad, I did something that my parents completely were like, what? I majored in not something that makes sense to most people. I majored in African World Studies. And then I got a master's in Pan-African Studies. But then I realized I wanted to really be able to reach our communities and tell our stories in an effective way. So I went back and got another master's in public relations. And I've merged those fields together, Africana Studies and Communications. And so what I've done is created a space and where we can tell the stories in a way that is effective, in a way that reaches people, in a way that people understand. I usually start with my own personal story. When I was a little girl, about 8 or 9 years old, my grandmother, Hattie Virginia Jones of Augusta, Georgia, sat down and told me our family story of how when she was a little girl, her mother and father, my great grandparents, had to escape off of a plantation from Warren, Georgia. This was the time of sharecropping. So slavery was over, but you couldn't really leave. If you were a sharecropper, people could go to jail. People could be killed for trying to escape off of those plantations. And that really meant a lot for her to tell me that story, because these are people that were alive when I was a little girl. My great-grandmother Flossie, my great-grandfather George, they gave me candy. I used to sit on their laps. They never told me any of that. You know, of course, they wouldn't tell a child the horrors they've been through. But when you grow up knowing, being able to touch, feel, understand, these are the people that we are fighting for their history and legacy. This is not something that happened a long time ago. That is my family. That is not some long distance story. That is now. I am their great granddaughter. I know these people. I know them. I am them. So I start with that story because one of the first things people say about reparations is that was so long ago. Slavery was so long ago. Nobody owes you anything. Nobody. And I'm like, no, it's actually not that long ago. And Jim Crow is right there. It's not just about chattel slavery, even though that's a huge component of it, but Jim Crow is sitting right there in your face. You turn your head and there's Jim Crow, where your parents had to be bussed into schools. It was yesterday, and the vestiges of it are today. So I start with those personal narratives and stories to really bring to light that the issue is current. It's also future. Just like what happened to my great-grandparents impacted me today, what happens to me today impacts my children and future generations. So reparations are not just past-looking, it's forward-looking. What do we want for the future of America? What do we want for the future of Black people in America and globally? Because if we don't make a change now, if we don't start restoring and repairing and doing the things that are needed to disentangle this beast, disentangle these systems that oppress us, what will the future look like? So I start with those personal narratives, those stories. I use a lot of our cultural understandings to really try to reach people in that way.
Do you think that there's a cultural shift that needs to happen in terms of collective responsibility? Because, a conservative might listen to what you just said and think, well, people should lift themselves up by their bootstraps, and even if it was a few generations ago, et cetera, et cetera. We have this individualist mindset in this country, manifest destiny, et cetera. We all, you know, this myth that those who have made it to the top have done so on their own, and everyone else who hasn't done so has just personally failed or just not been good enough.
That is so funny when people say the whole lift yourself up. They never say the pilgrims should have lifted themselves up. They never say that. They never say that, you know, the enslavers, maybe they should have picked the cotton. Maybe they should have lifted themselves up. Why did they go and get my ancestors? Why did they go and take Native Americans' land? Why did they do all of those things? They never say that these people should have lifted themselves up. It's only when it comes to us, when we have literally lifted this nation up. So it is such a big myth that it's like, I don't even like playing into it, feeding into it, because that has never been the case with this country, that people just were lifted up on their own and strove on their own. The way that it even came to be was based off of the backs and blood of Native Americans and Africans. So I don't want to hear anything about lifting yourself up by the bootstraps. We've done everything that we could. And on top of that, when we created our own communities, when we were striving and doing all these things on ourselves, what happened? Those communities were attacked. They were bombed. They were all type. They so many things were done by governments, local and nationally. So if we have to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps, why hasn't this nation done that? The nation couldn't even do it itself. So I just hate to even hear that argument. No. You know, it definitely does need to be a cultural change in how we look at even the founding of this nation, so that we can stop with that attitude that it was individuals that made it so, because that never happened.
And that's a huge reason why there are attacks on the teaching of history, because learning about how it really unfolded sheds light on exactly what you were just saying, right?
Yes. And that's one of the things we're also working on. We have a program called Project Protect Black History. And we are sending books to various places. We just participated in the Malcolm X Book Festival in Winter Park, Florida, sending thousands of dollars worth of books to the local community. And we're doing that in different spaces. But yes, that is part of it. When you don't teach the history, then people they are operating under a misconception. They think they know the full story and they don't. So it's very important to have that background. It's very important for our children to learn the history. It's very important for adults to relearn what we think we know about the founding of America, about chattel slavery, about Jim Crow, about all of it. Really, we really need an understanding of global history to truly even understand how this nation was founded and the systems of chattel slavery. But yes, once you minimize the history, it's kind of like being able to control the dialogue, thereby being able to control what people will support and control the either the momentum of a movement or the stagnation of a movement.
That's a great segue into discussing how remains this control, and unfortunately, our stories remain at the whims of algorithms written by the tech bros. Black Twitter was such a huge phenomenon. I mean, still is, but then along came Elon Musk, and now Twitter is in shambles. And I'm wondering if you worry about the consolidation of control of the digital storytelling means, you know, because generally when something is very successful but doesn't benefit the shareholders, along will come someone to try to monetize it or co-opt it or take it in another direction. You know, we may have these amazing storytellers on social media, but those companies are still being run by rich white men mm-hmm. who want to be in the pockets of people like Trump, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I think...
Sorry, that was a loaded question.
Yeah, it was. It's a lot. But I think that, you know, definitely, this is a big issue. Like, we often control dialogue or are able to push dialogue, but we don't own the space. And so it does make some of the movements vulnerable in that sense. Like, just like it, we're already vulnerable to intruders and misinterpretation. I do hope that one day we can have more of a public square. Mm-hmm. Twitter is considered to be the public square, but it was never really in the ownership of the public. I hope that one day we have something like that. But I'm also very confident in Black content creators that whatever happens, we'll find a way. We've done it before, we'll do it again. I think that we're very creative, malleable. We're able to, you know, look at various situations and navigate our way through it. But I do hope that we get more platforms that are more people focused and people controlled. That would be ideal. But yeah, we don't own most of those spaces.
If you could wave a magic wand and have one thing that you could do to further the goal of reparations, you know, being at this conference, that's a historic conference, what would you like to see happen or what would you like to be able to do?
Oh my gosh. One thing.
Can be a big thing.
Okay. If I would wave a wand and we would all have free housing, like, that was a major movement. After chattel slavery, people had to find a place to go. And we're still, you know, beholden. That's why many of our ancestors were beholden to sharecroppers. We were still on their land. After 40 acres and a mule, land was given and then taken back and given back to the former slave owners. And then they made our ancestors pay rent on the land that was supposed to go to them. And even Martin Luther King, before he passed away, he was leading the charge, one of the people leading the charge on the fair housing movement. And 7 days after he was assassinated, Lyndon B. Johnson got the Fair Housing Act passed through. Housing is a major issue with the issues with climate change that we've already known were coming, but now are smack dab in our face. We're going to have to have, we're going to have more and more housing issues, and we're going to have solutions. So if I could wave a magic wand, we'd all have free housing tomorrow.
Wow, wonderful. Where can people find you online and find out more about the work that you do?
For the National Black Cultural Information Trust, people can find us at nbcit.org and at nbcitrust on all social media.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Jessica Ann Mitchell Iwuyor, founder of the National Black Cultural Information Trust, during a recent conference on reparations in Atlanta, Georgia, produced for Yes Media, where I work as the racial justice editor. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.